Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Solid. It's Soraya here, and today I'm joined by my good friend Jordan to talk about the sci-fi classic Dune. So, Jordan, thanks for hanging out today.
Yes, hello. Happy to be here.
Spoiler alert. Hey, guys. Just as a heads up, we will be revealing spoilers in this episode. If you haven't yet read the book or seen the show or film, this is a courteous reminder to proceed with caution.
You actually suggested that we cover this book. I had never heard of it because somehow I had. I know you told me like it's really popular and it's inspired like a lot of the kind of sci-fi books and movies that are around today. So what were your initial thoughts?
Yeah. So this book, the preface to it was that it's an inspiration, like Soraya had mentioned, to like Star Wars. It's been stated that this book was like a true inspiration to it. And given that it was released in 1965 and Star Wars was in the 70s, it kind of, you can draw the line there. And yeah, we can talk about it, but even if you're familiar with Game of Thrones, you can see a lot of influence there. It's just a true, like, after reading it, a true testament to like the genre as a whole of sci-fi, of fantasy, of everything. So I'm excited to, you know, dive into our thoughts about it here.
Definitely. I know we talked about it a little bit off air, but the Game of Thrones comparisons for sure. Like the whole time I'm reading, I'm like, ooh, this person is like Littlefinger or Varys or whoever.
Spoiler alert, if you're not familiar with the Game of Thrones TV show, which neither of us have read the books.
No, yeah.
But if you're not familiar with it, we might spoil some things. But there's just, it's hard not to, because there's so many like direct comparisons where you can say that the inspiration was probably drawn from this book directly or at least slightly for certain characters or ideas. So
truly. And if you haven't watched Game of Thrones yet, like what are you doing?
Yeah, like you should do that.
that's more on you. So so this book, she's thick. Two C's. Mm-hmm. I'm actually really proud of us. I think we both read it in a week, so that's something.
But yeah, just about. So the audiobook version that I bounce back and forth from audiobook and reading it. And so the book, the version we have is like 650 pages, mm-hmm. and the audiobook was like 21 hours long. So it's a trek, but it's a worthy trek, though. It's worth getting through for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I really, I guess I'm just going to like move into initial thoughts when I was reading it. So I feel like most sci-fi books, fantasy, they're building a world, right? And so they have to introduce the reader or the watcher to that world. So they usually kind of guide you, like hold your hand and telling you what things are and who these people are and why they're important. No.
Nope.
Dune just like throws you in and they're like, you'll learn.
Yeah.
And you'll figure it out.
And I really appreciate that actually, because you do like very quickly, you don't really like feel out of place and like you're like observing, but rather that you're a part of it. And it's a style that I've noticed a lot have adopted since then. Like a lot of artists, a lot of creators have done that since then. And it's fascinating to me, because I would love to like be inside Frank Herbert's mind and understand how he did that. Like, do you think he like, I guess we haven't done research on it. I don't know really, mm-hmm. but like, I would wonder, like, did he write this all out in like a storyboard? Did he have like an idea of what this world was before he even started writing the book? Cause it feels so established that it feels like he did that almost.
I feel like you kind of have to, like, especially if you're going to bring the audience in just like mid action, so to speak.
Yeah.
Cause like, you know, I feel like if he was doing it as he went along, I mean, obviously there's edits and stuff when you're writing a book, but you'd be able to tell. It would feel clunky, but this feels fleshed out. And like you were saying, like, it's nice that he did it this way. I feel like it leaves much more room for a real story instead of like spending the first 150 pages trying to like get the reader caught up to what's going
on.
Whereas this, we got like a full-fledged action-packed story really from start to finish. So there wasn't like time wasted.
And not only that, but you can tell, especially in like movies or TV, when something is meant to be a pilot season and they don't know if it's going to be picked up again, like they don't know if there's going to be more to it. They'll, you know, establish everything, tie everything up, and then add things later where you're like, that didn't feel like it was meant to be there from the beginning. They just kind of like tacked it on. Nothing here feels like that at all. It feels like he thought out this whole story. And
it's
like, I know there's five more books in this series, which I might get around to reading at some point, but it feels like he had all of those already in mind of what he wanted to do or what's going to happen with them, just by the like style that this is written in. It feels like it's like a piece of a large puzzle, but can stand alone on its own and like a true novel by itself.
Like, yeah, like what was presented in this feels like it was wrapped up. I mean, like there's room, like you said, to grow, but it does feel like had this been the only one, you could be satisfied with the way that things ended.
Totally.
So like, okay, moving deeper into the book, I want to talk about Paul a little bit, just because he's like
The focal point.
The central character. Oh, and before we do that, I do think it's interesting that, like, while I would while I would call Paul probably the main character, I like that he did the point of view from, like, every character.
Yeah, yeah, it's an omniscient viewpoint. Yeah. So, like, you get to be in the head of every character. And that's something that's lost in, like, movies or, mm-hmm. like, and the movie comes out, by the way, in October, which is another reason why we did this. But it's something that truly is only in the book form where you can understand what every person's thinking and how they're thinking. And that's like a beautiful part of this entire experience, is that it's not any single group of people that it's limited to. It's literally every character mm-hmm. in the book. There's, I'm pretty sure there's some point in the book where every character you get to see inside their head and yeah. what they're thinking.
Yeah. And I thought that was bold because there are so many characters.
So
I mean, yeah. So, and, but it was, I think, in the end, it made the story better. Because, mm-hmm. like you said, you can understand the motivations behind each individual character. Or it's just kind of that feeling of, like, as a reader, knowing everything that's going on. Like, I haven't read a lot of books with, like, an omniscient narrator POV, at least in the last few years, maybe even at all. I feel like most just stick to, like, first or, like, third limited. But, yeah, I thought that was a really – it was – like I said, bold, because I don't think I would, it would be hard to keep track of that many characters. And, like, I know as a writer, you get into the mind of each character. And so doing that for, like, 15 people.
Yeah. Intimidating.
Seems daunting. Yeah.
And like, in that sense, it's crazy that he contained it to this many pages, because it feels like it's short when you consider how much content he really did pack in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, getting even to the first story point, like, something fascinating to me was that there is a treachery in place at mm-hmm. the beginning of the story. And they tell you right away. There's no surprise to yeah. that. Like, it's like you get into the head of the enemy, quote unquote, the Harkonnens. You're in their war room in, like, chapter four or something.
Three? Yeah.
Something, and they're early. Telling you about the treachery that they've planted in the Atreides and, like, how they're going to do this. Their whole plan is spelled out to you from the very beginning of the book.
Which almost made it, like, even more nerve-wracking, because, again, as the reader,
you're like, what's going to happen?
Please, someone figure it out. Oh, and that's what I was going to say, too, is I like that he didn't even just contain it to bouncing between these characters. Like, a lot of times when they do that, they keep it, like, separated by chapters. Mm-hmm. So this chapter's Paul, this chapter would be Jessica. But no, it's, like, mid-conversation, you're like, in Jessica's head, Paul's head, Stilgar's head. Like, it just bounces around.
Yeah, that's true. The perspective changes constantly. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel disjointed either.
No.
Like, it feels appropriate that it says, like, and Paul thinks in this moment, like, of this thing or whatever. And it's really interesting, the writing style. It's not something I've experienced before in, like, any kind of book, but it's great.
Yeah, no, I think because I know I said we haven't read Game of Thrones. I read, like, the first 50 pages, so to me that doesn't count as reading it. But if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure that that one, while it does have the point of view of multiple characters, I think it does separate it by chapter.
Right. So yeah. You get a perspective chapter from mm-hmm. one character, yeah, which this in this case it does not do that. But and it almost, interestingly, ties into the theme of the book itself. Because there's this, like, I mean, I guess we're getting into the content, but hopefully you've read it if you're listening to this, or you're just, you know, trying
they got
to
the spoiler.
Yeah. There's a spoiler tag in here, you know. But I think the, like, the omniscience angle, interestingly, ties in with the theme of the book, because Paul is that almost.
Right.
So it, like, kind of, like, gives you this presence of, like, you being Paul in a sense. But even then, Paul doesn't know everything, which I thought was, like, a fascinating way of showing his whatever he is,
yeah,
the Kwisatz Haderach, or the what's the other term that the Fremen use?
The
Lisan Al Gaib,
yes,
I think. Yeah.
Yes.
So all those things that he is or maybe, we don't even really get confirmation. I mean, I guess he is those things, but
he certainly,
what does it mean? You know,
because exactly.
Like other people have hints of that too. Like, you know, it's interesting the world that has been built and the rules that define it, right? Like, is there rules? It doesn't really, you know, lean into a hard set, this is the answer. It's like, what does it all mean?
And it changes too, I guess, mm-hmm. too, as the story goes on. And it's, so in the beginning, like, I think we realized fairly early that it's kind of like a chosen one type story.
Very much so, yeah.
And so, like, I love a good, you know, chosen one, fulfill the prophecy thing. But I was like, is it going to be cliche? Is it going to be kind of contrived? No.
No,
perhaps
definitely.
Because it's like...
And that's the crazy part to me. Because, again, I had to keep reminding myself that this was written in 1965. And, like, all of the stuff that we're familiar with came after mm-hmm. this. Because it doesn't feel unoriginal in that way. Like, it still feels like it stands alone as its own thing. And there are some, like, you know, more... I wouldn't say tropey, but kind of like standard passages. But then you realize that this might have been the book that set those, right? Like, this is the one that like kind of led other things to be modeled after that style.
Exactly.
So yeah, that's interesting to me that it doesn't, it feels like, if you would have told me this was written in 2005, I would have believed you. Like, it doesn't feel dated at all.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Cause, again, like, I think you're the one who told me it was written in the 60s. Like, right, as I mentioned in the beginning of this episode, I really wasn't familiar with Dune at all. There was like, when I was looking at a bookstore, I used to see it all the time, but that was like my exposure to it. And I was like, the 60s? Yeah, it right? just, it's aged beautifully. It doesn't feel like we said, it was a really thick book. And I was worried that I was going to have trouble getting through it at parts. It's like, oh, is it going to be boring? Is it going to be slow? Like, to fill 600 plus pages and make it engaging the entire time is a feat. And mm-hmm. that's exactly what he did. So I know we're kind of talking about Paul a little bit, so I really want to dig into him because I think he's a really interesting character. Like, for the first 3/4 of the book, I was like, I was kind of blown away by him. I was like, okay, dude is something else.
What's interesting about Paul, and I find it like, there's an arc to him for sure. I mean, there's an arc to every character in the book, but at the beginning, he's very centered and like understands, and is everyone like remarks that he's very aged for his age. Mm-hmm. He's like 15 years old at the beginning, but everyone, his own father, the Duke, says, treat him as an adult. He's not a child. Like, don't talk to him like he's a child. But Paul doesn't seem to think of himself the same way that everyone else does. It doesn't seem like he's very aware. His mother's training, the Bene Gesserit training that he has gone through to notice subtleties in people's actions or like motives, voices, whatever. He's very aware of that, but he doesn't seem to be aware of the fact that everyone else around him views him differently, if that makes sense.
No, I understand. No, I get what you're saying. Like, I think everyone could see that he was different.
Right.
Or could be different, would mm-hmm. be different. Like, and he said, except him.
But it's almost like he didn't quite understand that yet. And then later in the book, he's very aware of how different he is and yeah. very confident about it, actually.
It was almost, I was kind of like, towards the like last quarter, I was like, okay, I wonder if we're going, like, and you, before we started recording, kind of compared it to Daenerys, I was like, is he going to get unhinged
right.
from this power? Because yeah. especially that final scene with like the Empire, the Emperor and the Harkonnens and stuff, I was like, dude, everyone's telling you, like, don't do this, don't do that.
Or and we he's should. Just,
and he's yeah. like, no, we're doing it. No, this is going to happen. Like, he was just right. not even kind of entertaining what anyone else had to say or think. And I was like, is he about to lead them all into yeah. defeat with his arrogance?
And, you know, that's an interesting aspect to it as well. And something, I don't know if anyone would be familiar with the Watchmen comics or the movie, whatever you could say. But he also has very Dr. Manhattan vibes in the end of it. And what I mean by that is Dr. Manhattan is a like omnipresent being that can see all of time. So he becomes very, what's the word for it? I guess like unbothered with what's currently happening because he knows what's going to happen over the course of thousands of years or whatever. So he doesn't like feel sad or, you know, bothered by what's happening now because he knows in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to matter. And in Watchmen, he ends up like removing himself from like society basically and living on Mars by himself because he's like, humanity sucks. But anyway, but like Paul kind of has inklings of that in this. And you could probably see the inspiration there for Watchmen actually, because he kind of starts to, you know, even in his own head, wonder, why don't I feel mourning for when my dad dies? Or why don't I feel mourning for when my son dies? Like, I don't feel allowed to do that, but it's because of what I know or what I see or whatever.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. Cause like, yeah, I'm not familiar with Watchmen, but like that perfectly sums it up. Like, I think that explains his behavior in that scene where he's like,
right.
they're like, the storm's coming. We should, you know, get
he's
to cover.
So self-assured. Or we should, yeah.
yeah. And he's like, I already know this is going to be fine.
Right.
And so I was worried that arrogance was going to be his defeat, but no,
but
like
maybe
he
it
was
is, though. Like, because I mean, this is a 6-book series, right? Which we haven't gotten into, but like maybe that's the story that we're telling is kind of a Daenerys-esque, too confident in his actions, maybe, because of what he's seen.
And it's funny because I think he finally has a moment of realization towards the end because he's trying to prevent, like, the, what's it called, the jihad?
Yeah, the jihad, it's basically viewed as, like, a conquest of, like, the Fremen, like, and it's almost like, they describe it as, like, a religious way, it seems
yeah.
Like, it's like a, their right to the galaxy or something along the lines of that, and he wants to prevent that, which is a noble thing.
Right.
But then it's like, why does he want to prevent that? It's interesting, right? Like,
and,
what
and
is
so deeply, like, I right. think that's his main driving force throughout the entire book is I cannot let this happen. It's why.
Right. And the fascinating thing, and it's such an interesting way to write things, because he talks about, I think these time, what does he call them? Strands or something along the lines of that. And he says that he has a prescience visions, right? And that there's these nexus events where he doesn't know, kind of like they talk about it in Loki, funny enough, these nexus events, but he doesn't know what's going to happen past this point. And at the climax of the novel, the end of the book, where he's dueling with Fade Rautha Harkonnen, he doesn't know what's going to happen, but he conceptualizes in his head that whether he lives or dies, that the danger of this jihad afterwards can go on regardless.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating. Like, he basically says, like,
he becomes a martyr essentially. Yeah. If he dies. Yeah.
He basically says, like, I have to live here because either way it can still happen. But if I die, it will definitely happen because I've become this martyr like image for these people to then go on and, you know, take over the galaxy or whatever they're going to do.
And it's really interesting because you're seeing, like, you know, maybe later in the books that does end up happening, you know, that he becomes Daenerys like with his power. And I do find, like, maybe that's foreshadowing. There's a line towards the end, I think Jessica says, about, like, all, what did she say? Like, all prophets or also meet a violent end or something like that.
Right.
And it was,
yeah, it's like a Bene Gesserit like saying or something. Yeah, which
an
is
axiom, I think they call it.
Yeah. Speaking of that, like, it's interesting Paul's dynamic with his mother, in the sense of, like, at first she's training him and sees something special in him, and then she's afraid of him by the end of the book. Like, she does not feel like he is any more her son. He is something else. Like, he is not even a human. Like, a lot of them describe it as, like, he's not a person anymore. He is something different.
And even with her being, like, her training and her being the Reverend Mother, like, she, with all her abilities, she still can't, like, figure him out or, like, see him. Mm-hmm. And I think that terrifies her.
That's
as
what scares
well.
Her, yeah, which is interesting. But even then, like, towards the beginning, before he becomes this, like, this figure to the Fremen and, like, this, like, interesting, like, leader that sees all, just in the inklings of, like, when they're in the tent together in the desert and they're escaping the, like, sure death that they were gonna have, she was afraid of him then.
Yeah,
she, like, his first visions of this, and I think it was what even activated that, was like spice or something activated it in him.
Yeah, it enhances it, because he always kind of had it, like, even on like Caladan,
because he'd have dreams. Right, he would have dreams about it.
But to me, the catalyst was, like, when his dad died.
Yeah,
he snapped.
Must have been like his, like, active moments where he starts to see everything. That chapter was hard for me to, like, get through, because I was trying to figure out, like, it's like we were saying, like, there's moments in the book where you read these, like, paragraphs of, like, time folding in on itself, and you're like,
he's like,
what?
The future became the past. I was like, I have no idea.
What?
Sure.
But it did kind of, like, maybe it's supposed to confuse you, because the way it's written is not supposed to make sense, probably.
And it doesn't even make sense to him.
It doesn't make sense to him.
Like, he dreads these moments.
Right.
And I can't even imagine, too, like, losing your grip on reality like that. He can't control it.
Or I thought that another interesting moment with Paul was when, I think it's the beginning of the third book, like, when it skips ahead a couple of years, and he doesn't know what time he is in.
Yeah.
Like, he's wondering, like, is Chani with my child in the south? Or did she yesterday morning tell me that she was, like, you know?
And he's like, do I even have a child? Did that happen
did
yet?
That happen
and he's
yet?
Like, did my mom have my sister?
Like, he knows it's going to happen, but he doesn't know where he is in the timeline.
That's
which
terrifying.
Is crazy and interesting. Like, and yeah, just wild that that's kind of, like, his deal. So then, like, you wonder, like, is it power, or is it, like, this overwhelming presence of knowing something that no one else does that, like, maybe almost annoys him to an extent?
Well, it's actually, he did when, right. Like, when that all kind of first settled in after his dad died, and it was him and his mom, and he kept thinking, like, how does she not see that yet?
Right.
How is she, like, why is she one step behind? And he was getting annoyed with her, because this was the first moment that he was finally able to kind of see more than she was. And I was like, and I liked their, like, relationship. I mean, it's kind of tumultuous at times, but I did like it. And so those moments where it seemed like when he was mad at her for finding out, when he found out, like, she was a Harkonnen or whatever, or her being afraid of him, it did make me stress. Cause, like, I don't want something to tarnish what they have. I don't know what they have right now because it's a mess. But yeah, it definitely seemed like there were times where they were pulling apart from each other.
Right. Yeah. And it's like the influence of the outside was doing that, or, like, if internally they were having those conflicts. But yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting dynamic. And also something that I find fascinating about Paul's character that I've never really seen in another, like, medium of any sort, is that every situation is different for him. Like, for example, the fight with between him and Fedrotha, or the fight between him and the other Fremen.
Jamis,
the other Fremen that he ends up killing. Those moments, he sees a nexus of possibilities, but doesn't know which one's the truth or what's going to happen. It's like he doesn't have a true vision of the future because it'll alter based on what he does. But then, like, it's fascinating because these moments are so important to him, and other people don't realize that, like, which is probably part of his frustration as well.
How much hinges on this one.
Right, moment, like, yeah. Right, because there's moments where, to other people, like, for example, the assault at the end on, like, the Emperor's ship and all of that, they were all questioning his decisions of, like, but the storm's coming, but this, this, and this, and he's, like, so sure because he knows exactly what's going to happen in those moments, he just tells them, no, do this, no, do this. But then in these moments where they're confused as to why he's doing it, it's because he doesn't know what's going to happen, so he needs to approach it himself. And it's almost like he feels he needs the control, you know? Like, he has to control that moment because it's the only thing he doesn't know, maybe?
Yeah.
And maybe that's what leads to his downfall at some point? I don't know. I'd be interested to see it.
I mean, I don't even know how do you accept that? Like, I feel like that is a... He calls it his terrible... What does he call it?
His terrible purpose. He has a terrible purpose.
And that perfectly sums it up to me, because I would hate to have that knowledge.
Right.
I would hate to constantly... Every decision you make, something as simple as, you know, turning right instead of left, like, and seeing the way that that could unfold. And like you said, not having a definitive answer, and just knowing that it's all very fluid, like, not what's the point, but it's just, it is like a burden. Yeah. I don't know how you could even accept that or function as a human, which he doesn't, because they always say he's not human. So that, you know, perfectly explains it.
Or it's interesting how he sees moments in time, like places, as a moment that is important to him. Like, for example, he says, in this cave, something happens. Like, he doesn't know what's going to happen.
He knew he'd meet Chani, yeah.
Right. Like, he's like, in this cave, there is a nexus of possibilities, and I don't know why. But, like, here, I feel something different about
it. It's going to, dramatically alter the future.
And I think there was moments in the book where it wasn't even then. Like, he just would enter a place and knew something dramatic would happen here, but he didn't know when. Like, which was fascinating.
Yeah, Paul is, he's really, really interesting to me. And, Jessica. I love Jessica.
She really kind of, I don't know, man. She's like, it really, the whole thing kind of hinges on her, doesn't it? Because all the decisions she makes is really what ends up influencing everything.
Yeah, I mean, she's the one who chose to have a boy instead of a girl, and now look where we are.
And she's the one who chose to take the test to be the Reverend Mother of the Fremen, too. Like that. And Paul was like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
like,
he was still confused.
He didn't know what was going to happen, but he just watched and was confused. And, like, that whole thing was fascinating with, like, the way that, like, she now is all of the Reverend Mothers,
and,
but
like,
then so is her daughter, who's, like, 4 years old at the end of the book.
Yeah. Oh, I love her, too. Like, just the women in this book are really intricately written.
Mm-hmm.
I
think it's such a, like, interesting approach for, again, like, maybe I'm discrediting the author by saying this, but in the 60s, the concepts that he's talking about feel very modern. Like, he's posing this world that feels very average, like almost Middle Ages, in the sense of, like, there are, you know, patriarchies, and the women are, like, the kind of accessories to it almost, or, like, they, you know, will marry into families, and that's how they bridge the gap or whatever, and there's not really any, like, stock in the women. There's no women rulers, it seems like, in this society. And that's a very, like, you know, archaic thing. But the way that he has the, like, women characters in this novel navigate that is fascinating, because they are this, like, these layered people who use it to their advantage and know that that's the way it is, but also know how to pull the strings correctly, which is fascinating. Like, because she, the Bene Gesserit and her in general, she knows how to play that game and, like, how to use it to her advantage, which is so interesting.
Yeah, there was a part in the very beginning, like, some of the, I think it was a few male characters were talking about the women, and I was like, at first I was like, it was giving me, like, a little bit, like, just, like, kind of misogynistic vibes,
yeah,
and I was
sure.
like, is this, I couldn't tell at that moment, I was like, okay, is this the writer coloring it with his own views?
Right.
But no, like you said, it was him. He did show that that's what a lot of the characters thought about these women, but then used the women to flip that notion on its head.
Exactly.
And like you're saying, like, they always wrote her off, Jessica, and a lot of the women, but Jessica in particular, like, oh, just calling her, like, that Bene Gesserit witch, or, like, not, they just completely underestimated her. And then every time she was able to best them, and I was like, okay, just keep underestimating her. Like,
Speaking of, that scene with Thufir, where she calls him in because she hears that thinks that she's the traitor.
That was when I texted you, dude, and I was like, Jessica it's like is the baddest chick.
She literally hits him with, like, Dark Knight Rises, puts the hand on the shoulder, do you feel in control? Like, basically hits him with the Bane line, right? Like, tells him, like, you're not, like... Like, if I wanted the Duke dead, he would have been dead.
Yeah, like, or if I wanted him to marry him, yeah, he would have. Like, yeah. That moment, I was like, I'm so Jessica fan for life.
Yeah, because for real.
They all think that she is nothing, or that she just...
It's kind of confusing because they dismiss her, maybe just because she's a woman, which is kind of like the commentary on, like, the patriarch society in this. But then they are also confused and afraid of her a little bit.
Because they don't understand
her. They don't understand her, right? And Thufir is kind of like, I don't like her trickery because I don't understand her, all these things. But then she really, like, shows off the fact that she's like, I really have control over what can happen here, but I'm allowing this to happen. And it's interesting because her reasoning is very human. It's not very cold and calculating like the Mentats are shown. She says that she loves the Duke, truly.
And doesn't want him to marry her because she forced him to.
Right. And she understands. And that's the interesting thing is that she is a character who understands the way that the society works. She's like, his marriage to someone else is more impactful than I know that he loves me. So, like, that's such like an interesting thing to be like so confident in. She's just like, yeah, whatever. He doesn't have to marry me. I already know that I got him.
And I like that he didn't use Jessica to fulfill like petty stuff like that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like having this immense ability and then having her use it on making someone marry her or, you know, bending to the whims of people around her. Like it wasn't used for insignificant things. She was incredibly powerful and used her power in a very wise way.
Yeah. And that was a very like mature and woke concept. Again, like maybe saying for the 60s, it feels very mature for that. But like she never uses her powers in ways that don't make sense long term.
Right.
Because she goes like, I know I could bend anybody to do my will or whatever, but that doesn't instill faith in anyone else. Like, for example, when they meet the Fremen, she's considering trying to marry Stilgar because that would be good for her and her son. Like, she knows that's an advantage that she could just trick him into doing whatever she wanted him to do. But she didn't have to do that and knew that there was other ways that would be better in like the current construct that was set in place in their society as well.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I love the way she was written. I think she's incredible and I hope she makes it around or sticks around for a lot of the series because she's just fascinating. And even Aaliyah, I know I kind of said it before, I think we talked about it off air. She was so interesting to me too.
This little girl that is like actually
like
hundreds of years old or something.
And like the stuff she's saying. And it bothers me because like the Fremen, they know Jessica and Paul so well at this point. It kind of surprises me that they're so resistant or like hesitant to accept Aaliyah. Mm-hmm. Like they think she's a demon or whatever. And I'm like, but you know what Jessica is and can do. So it only makes sense that she would, especially what happened, that she would birth a child.
But that's what was kind of interesting too, is that they kind of did after like Jessica, like kind of explained to them, like that she's basically me, like she, something happened. And then they were like, oh, okay. Like they're like,
oh, what was her name? Hara?
Yeah. Who was Jaymus's wife, right? Yeah. It didn't really clear up how exactly what happens with her. Cause like, I guess she was Paul's servant for a while, but.
And then he can free her, but it doesn't seem like he ever freed her. Cause he said he would free her after a year.
Yeah. I don't really know what happens. They're like policy, you know, their culture regarding that was kind of interesting. But yeah, they never really mentioned what happens to her, but like, yeah, she kind of like, was also like, it seems like everyone trusted Paul and Jessica very much, like including the Fremen, like they just very much put all their faith into them. And they thought that the daughter was like a demon or weird or whatever. And then they just basically explained to them like, no, she's like just
she's
one
just
of us.
Different.
Yeah. And then they're like, oh, all right. She's just an adult then.
So wait, going back really quick to the Reverend Mother ceremony, that part where she was like, okay, I have to look inward. And she like broke down the molecular structure of the poison. She's like, okay, just substitute carbon here. That was so cool.
Yeah.
That was really cool.
A really cool way to write that too. Like so interesting. She was literally breaking down the poison into like bit by bit, molecule by molecule and rearranging it, which I think was a really interesting thing because they mention a lot of interesting things like that in like the Bene Gesserit training where like fascinating the way the book's written, by the way, when they like, that's what I love about hearing their like thoughts individually, mm-hmm. because Jessica throughout the book is like looking at people and listening to their tone of voice, like certain things about like the way they look at other people. Like, and that's so cool because very few stuff I've read or like watched really focuses on that. But she's like, based on the way this person looked at this person at dinner, I know that they have something going on between them. Like, super interesting.
Yeah. Or the scene, that's the dinner
scene.
Yeah. Where she was like, okay, he said that on purpose to try to bait someone into this. And she's right. Like, okay, now he's going to say something about that. And then that seems innocent, but it's not. And then he did. And I was just, oh, it was written.
Like, she knows
so
how
well.
It's going to play out, yeah. But she doesn't have like the future sight that Paul has. She just can read people at like a base level and understand all of their motivations, like in moments of looking at them.
Right.
Which is such a cool, like, aspect to a character,
which to me, I don't understand how then she especially didn't suspect that
doctor, yeah,
that he was the traitor.
Mm-hmm.
I kept waiting for someone to figure it out, and it drove me nuts.
That's kind of the missing puzzle piece for me. Like, how did no one suspect? And I guess, like, I don't know, with this world that's built around, like, maybe there's just no instance where a doctor from that Imperial training school has ever broken that or something. But then, like,
there's a first time
for everything. There's a first time for everything. And don't you think that a Bene Gesserit would be the one that would be willing to suspect that at, like, the base level?
And someone she knows so well, like, she knows everything about him. Like you said, his tone of voice, his mannerisms. So and there is a scene where they're talking and she notices something's kind of off, but she chalks it up to like him being grieving over his wife, I think.
Right. But that's interesting too, because they mention the reason why they discount him even, and they even consider it, like a few of the characters, I think Jessica, they say like, well, maybe he could have it could have been broken, like his like training or whatever. But then she says, but he hates the Harkonnens more than any of us because they killed his wife. But why did none of them ever connect the dots of like, well, he hates them because of what they did to him, but don't you think that means they could also hang something over him? Like,
exactly. And actually, I think Paul finally says something about it at the end. He was like, my father's mistake was thinking that just because someone hated someone didn't mean that they could still...
Oh.
I can't
beautifully
remember
written,
quote.
Too.
Yeah.
Because, like,
it's
it was
such a good quote.
He basically says something along the lines of, like, the Atreides operate in love instead of hate.
Right.
And, like, the love for each other and their people is really what pushes them forward. And the Harkonnens operate in hate. And he said something along the lines of, my father misjudged the usage of hate or something because he never used it himself.
Yeah.
Which was
yeah.
really interesting because that was basically the downfall of Yui, was that he hated the Harkonnens so much that he was willing to go to any length to make sure that they would be destroyed.
I think that's what it was. He's like, he made the mistake of thinking just because like you share a common enemy, that means they'll be loyal to you
right,
or something
yeah.
like that. And I was just, oh, Paul, his insight, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really, the writing style is gorgeous because some of the things that are said, I'm like, that's really perceptive mm-hmm. or just like philosophical even. Like, and so it's like, obviously the writer had to think about that.
Yeah.
And so he himself is obviously incredibly
intelligent. I was going to say, you get an insight into Frank Herbert because he writes things so eloquently mm-hmm. and like the characters think about things in ways that don't really dawn on you just reading it. And you're like, wow, that's so perceptive. Yeah. Like you said, perceptive of like, analyzing the situation, and you're like, wow, that means that he understands
right.
like humans at a very like, you know, fundamental but also deep level. I would love to know, I mean, I haven't done any research on the author. I'd love to know if he had like a psychology background or something, because he talks so much about like the intricacies. It would make sense, right?
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the Harkonnens briefly, because like, you know, it starts, we obviously know that the Harkonnens and the Atreides don't really like each other, and then like I think I wrote in my notes on point, I was like, I too despise the Harkonnens.
Yeah. Yeah.
They are, the Baron is, okay, that, the scene with, was it Feyd-Rautha, is that his name?
Yeah, Feyd-Rautha, yeah.
When he was doing his, like, gladiator, whatever.
Yeah.
He was so cocky, I was ready for him to get iced in that scene.
I thought he was going to die there, actually.
I did too.
As I was reading it, I was like, maybe he dies right here because he's overconfident.
Exactly.
And he almost did, right?
He,
like, he almost
they cheated.
Did. Yeah.
And I thought, like, the slave and himself, they were both going to die in that scene. And I would have been perfectly okay with it. Because, like, again, comparing it to Game of Thrones, like, he just kind of reminded me of Joffrey for some reason.
Very much that vibe, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, you know what? I'm ready for him to die in this arena. It's his birthday. He's terrible. Like, please.
Get him out.
Get rid of him.
Get him out. I also thought it was interesting how this character, I mean, it's kind of tied to the Harkonnens, but the Count Fenring.
Oh, yeah.
What an interesting character to write into a novel, because, like, he's not in very much of it at all. Like, in a couple chapters, he's, like, not even the focal point, really. He just exists. But at the end of the novel, he's, like, this realization that Paul has where mm-hmm. he's, like, you're like me. And he said that he feels a sense of brothership.
Brotherhood, yeah.
Yeah, brotherhood for him. And, like, that's such an interesting concept because that's not where I thought that was going to go at all.
At all. And the fact that Count Fenrir felt it as well and told the Emperor, like, I'm not going to duel him.
Like, in that moment, they just looked at each other and kind of nodded and were like,
all right.
I respect you, which was really interesting and, like, not at all where I thought that character was going to go. I thought he was, like, slimy and felt like a gross, like, assassin
like
kind of type.
Like a little finger or something.
Yeah, kind of. And that's kind of the vibe you had throughout the whole thing. But then at the end, I was like, wow, what an interesting character to write in. And Paul even mentions, the reason why I can't see any past with him in it or any future with him in it is because he's like me. Mm-hmm. So he can see similar things that I can. So that's why we can't see each other.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Was no one going to comment on the fact that, like, the Baron wanted young men who looked like Paul?
Yeah, ooh. I'm glad that never got, like, deeper, because I was like, yo, like, that's gross. Like, he was into little boys. That was kind of weird.
Yeah, and it was...
And it always mentioned that in his thoughts, he, like, would look at Fade Rautha and be like, what a, like, good-looking young boy.
Like,
and
I'm like, ugh.
And that guy was gross, by the way, but... Yeah,
I love that, but that's interesting.
Right. But it's interesting that the way that the Harkonnens are written, because they were, you know, harsh and brutal, but not necessarily like stupid or like, you know how like a lot of evil characters are written in a way where they just do things that are evil and it doesn't make sense.
Just like brutish.
Yeah. Like they were just very cold and calculating, similar to like the Lannisters or something along the lines of that in, you know, Game of Thrones. They were very aggressive and did things in a harsh, brutal way, but it didn't seem out of place in like the grand scheme of like these great houses and how they thought and how they operated, which, by the way, I'm sure that it continues on to describe more of them, but it's fascinating. This entire book is written on like two of them, and there's probably a bunch more because they talk about how there was like their ships were in space above them. So there's all these other grand houses that we don't even hear about. But
yeah, it's interesting because you do think like the Baron does, he seems like in another book or movie, I could easily see him being just like dumb and like they always talk about how much he loves food and being like this kind of
like aloof to the like dangers because he feels so confident
and
in the
protected
way of, like,
by their wealth and
but
status.
He never was that way though. He was actually very clever and smart. Yeah, like because I mean there was the scene with the poison where he was the only one that escaped because he noticed something was up, and like he was very like quick to not like be caught up in his own thoughts or fears. Like he would, in that scene, the way they described him, he was literally just facing death and then goes outside and just immediately starts barking orders and like and telling like how to wrap up the situation basically.
And for the most part, I mean, he didn't seem to view death and killing people as like a mundane pleasure. I mean, there was that, like when he found out that Fade Rautha tried to poison him, he made him like go kill all those people unnecessarily. But like even when he was talking about like using Thufir, that's how you pronounce it, right? I didn't Jordan listened to the audiobook and I read it, so I'm like really unsure about a lot of the pronunciations. But it was like everything had a purpose. Even killing someone had a purpose. Like killing Yue, it wasn't like he was trying to take pleasure in killing him, but he was just like, he's a liability now and I have to do this.
That's what I was gonna say. Like even when he like orders Fade Rautha to do like that big slaughter, like that was like a showing of power. Like he did that for a reason, to show the people like, hey, like we're not to be messed with or whatever, which I guess is an approach, right? And it's just their house's like style of doing things, I guess. But the Harkonnens are, again, even well written. They're the natural foil to the Atreides, right? They're the like quote unquote bad guys in it, but they don't feel like they're just the bad guys, right? There's like a layers to this. And hell, I mean, they were even family, right?
Because Paul, cousins, right? Yeah. No.
Jessica was the daughter of the Baron, right? Himself.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was saying cousins, disgusting you, but that was the Emperor and the Atreides. Okay, something I was really unclear about, why was the Emperor trying to get rid of the Atreides family?
Yeah, so that was interesting. I thought that maybe he felt they were a threat. Like, that's kind of what it seemed like. Like, it's like they were the only real threat to his eminent domain, right? Yeah. Because he knew that the Harkonnens, it seemed like the Harkonnens were kind of like tucked under his wing, like he could kind of make them do what he wanted them to do, and they had control over the, you know, Arrakis, over Dune. And maybe he didn't feel that way about the Atreides, and I know because they don't really like explicitly describe it in the book that well, but it seems like there's like a rotation to who controls Arrakis, right? Because the Harkonnens had it for like 80 years or something, they said, and then now it's being passed off to the Atreides almost. So maybe there's like this like system of like a cycling of houses being able to rule Dune because of the spice that they all want to control.
That well.
Also, sorry, this is like a tangent, but a topic I really wanted to cover. Fascinating the way that Paul analyzes the fact that the guild don't want direct control over Dune, Wasn't that interesting?
They turn around toward the end?
Yeah, because he mentions that they don't want actual possession of Dune because then they can be attacked for it because their like need of it is obvious. Right. Where if they let other people rule it, but then they still get their spice.
To extort that spice. Yeah,
they get to have it forever and like still be operating in the background, which was fascinating. And I think interesting how like the guild isn't super like prominent in the novel, but you can see that like they're the, like the ruling body, kind of almost
pulling the strings.
Yeah, it seems like the emperor is like a figurehead. Like he's not even that important in the grand scheme of things, and the guild is really who's like in charge. It's kind of like, I mean, it's a commentary on society, right? Like capitalism, like the most money is what's in control, not royalty or whatever.
And I did love his like, because I know like I said Paul was kind of getting unhinged for the answer. To me it looked like he was perhaps becoming a bit unhinged, but his like, I'll destroy the spice right here, right now.
Say I won't. I'll do it.
They're like, you wouldn't dare.
He's
try
like,
me.
Bet. And then they look to them and they're like, he's not joking. The shorter one or whatever. He's like, he looks up at the tall one. He's like, he ain't playing. I'm like, he'll do it.
Yeah, I thought that was because he was just, and again, because he knows what will happen.
Right.
So he's not really that pressed about it. I thought that was really interesting. And oh, the Duke as well. So it's funny. I don't know why, but going into the book, I just feel like father figures in books like of this type tend to kind of just be like jerks, like kind of aliens.
Yeah,
and but he so wasn't. No, yeah. I was expecting to not like the Duke. I thought I'd be kind of like cold and hard and not very compassionate toward Paul or Jessica.
But not I really like that liked at all. Him. He was
he was hardcore bug.
I mean, he was Ned Stark, really. Like he was Ned Stark.
Was, okay.
He was hard and steadfast in like his ruling and in the way he said things, but he was compassionate towards people in ways that didn't feel like weak. You know what I mean? Right. Like he was very like strong, but still able to show that he cared, which is fascinating.
There's a line again. I should have put sticky notes in here so I can remember the line specifically, but Jessica even said something. She was like thinking about him after he died. And she was like, oh, like my poor Duke, he was, what'd she say? Loyal almost to a fault, or like naively loyal or mm-hmm. something like that.
And he really was.
Is that not Ned Stark? You know what I mean?
Yeah, like they have their
code and they'll die by that code.
He was willing to die to the fact that someone else would have to be the like unfaithful person, basically, mm-hmm. because he was never going to lie or like do anything wrong to someone that he promised he wouldn't.
And Gurney stresses that multiple times mm-hmm. once he comes across Paul later, like after a few years have passed, he was like, your father cared more about the men he would lose than
the equipment.
And Paul's always, he's like, people are not expendable, but he's not really that worried about the people who are dying.
Again, it's the problem of him being like omniscient almost. He's like, this doesn't matter. Like that in the grand scheme of things, this has to happen. Right. But Gurney kind of grounds him a little bit in that sense, which is, I like Gurney's character a lot in that regard.
I'm glad he made it.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I don't think they've ever mentioned that Duncan died because they don't.
Yeah, they don't.
So he might be out there. Yeah,
they say that he saw like the wound on his head, and there was no way he'd live through it. But yeah, no one ever knows for sure. I was really surprised that Kynes died.
Yeah, very quickly too. Like, and it was like, and, you know, it was an interesting way they wrote it because like it always like he was the whole time like, oh yeah, someone will come get me. Someone will come get me.
They'll see me for sure.
And then he just dies to the planet himself that like he
that he's trying
cultivated.
To save. Yeah. That was
kind of a poetic ending for Kynes though, and interesting, and I guess necessary because someone had to fill the void of what he left, right? But
yeah, that really surprised me. I definitely just thought he was, and he was someone too at first. I was like, can we trust him? Are we allowed? Because
he
was saying like mm-hmm. he seemed a little duplicitous in his behavior.
Yeah, great writing style, by the way, because like you expect like he's working for the emperor, mm-hmm. so he's keeping things from Paul. That's Paul's noticing. Like he's keeping things from the Duke. He's not saying things. He's not like. He's changing the way he says certain words and Paul's noticing. Paul's noticing he's leaving out information. And the whole time it's being alluded to the fact that maybe he's like working for the emperor. Well, he obviously is and he doesn't want to reveal enough. But really, he was the Fremen leader all along and he was not wanting to be any part. Yeah.
And I loved too that scene where it was like the Duke, Paul, Kynes, and I think Gurney. Maybe when they were flying out to see like the spice being mined. And that chapter ended with Kynes thinking like he's like against my better judgment I like the Duke after all
that. The Duke is kind of that like the Duke Leto is like that character of like he's likable to a fault, like he like everyone that he interacts with ends up liking mm-hmm. him, like Stilgar when he just meets him in that one moment likes him afterwards, like all of them have this respect for him, and I think that ends up helping Paul in the long run, right, with the Fremen, because he's his son, and they remember the Duke as, right, like, this person who was very noble and true to his word.
I almost wish we could get, like, a, maybe there is one, I have no idea, I don't know enough about the series, but I would want some kind of prequel or something with more of the Duke, because I feel like there's a lot to kind of be
what made him the way
there.
He was.
Yeah, yeah. I would just be interested to see, because he was a much more likable character than I was anticipating.
Yeah, like you said, just not the cold, brooding person that you would expect. Mm-hmm. Truly a Ned Stark in the sense, yeah, of like the way that, and again, maybe that's the inspiration. Like, a lot of the characters in here feel like you can directly draw lines and connect them, like, this person's like that one in Game of Thrones, yeah, directly. So I'd like to say that Gurney is an interesting character as well, because he was kind of just like, it sounds like, just making his own living on the planet, like, yeah, just like
after,
like,
everyone died,
yeah, yeah, like working with, like, smugglers basically for a few years, and then he runs into Paul and he's like, you can't trust these guys, by the way. He's like,
he's like, just a heads,
like,
up.
Yeah, he walks in and he's like, yep, I'm loyal to you, you can't trust these guys. Like, let's get out of here. And he just kind of slipped right back into it, which was interesting because it showed the, like, another angle to the, like, undying, like, love for the Atreides family. Like, their loyalty was, like, to them no matter what. Mm-hmm. But Paul was also vice versa, that loyal to Gurney. Isn't there a moment where he said, you can strike me down right here or whatever? Something along the lines of,
oh,
that.
Yeah.
Oh, he does it for Thufir, which was fascinating. Yeah,
yeah, he was like, if you want to do it, now's the time.
He's like, if you're going to kill me, do it. And he was, like, confident in the sense that Thufir was always loyal to their family.
Even
and
being
he
with turns, the Harkonnens for 2 years.
And he turns back to the Emperor and shows him the thing that he was going to make him kill him with. And he's like, I'm not going to do it. And, like, drops it. That was the sickest mic drop, like, of all time. Like, that was so cool. And, like, again, Thufir is an interesting character because they don't really do much from his angle past, like,
yeah, like the raid or whatever.
Yeah, past when he gets captured. But you can tell, like, in the writing style, he's working in the background to still help. Like, if there's any chance that, like, the Atreides can, like, get out of this, because he thought they were all dead, but he still was trying to, like, take down the Harkonnens, mm-hmm, and, like, help in that way, which is interesting.
Yeah, I, this book, I mean, it was just infinitely better than I thought it was going to be. And not like I thought it was going to be bad.
Yeah, but old books, you kind of have, like, that, like, is it dated?
Old,
is
long
it,
books.
Right, yeah. Like, is it only loved because of what came from it, not because of what the actual content is? But this one is truly, like, a timeless piece, and it's, yeah, surprising to me that there was not a big budget film made for this up until this year. I know there was, like, a movie that they made that wasn't very good, not very high budget. There was, like, a TV series or something that also wasn't very good, but this is, like, the first time they're, like,
this
really
correct
Star Warsing, yeah, it, you know what I mean, like, putting money into it. And it seems like a shame that no one ever did, because this deserved it. I mean, this could have been Star Wars in another, right, like, angle, right, because they wrote Star Wars kind of in
the same
you can
vein.
See the inspirations, yeah.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited for the movie. The cast is impeccable.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Of course, like, I looked at the cast before I started reading, so, yeah, like, that's all I can see. Yeah, like, too, Timothy, yeah, Chalamet and Paul is, like, the only thing I could see. But
we know it's Chalamet, we just call him Timothy.
Thank you for that. Yeah, it just, I'm really excited. I think it's going to be really good, and I don't be daunted by the length. For any of you who haven't read it, it's just so good and so worth it.
It goes by really quickly.
It does.
Like, honestly, like, it's a long book, and there are moments that, you know, describe nuances. They describe small details about things, but they don't ever feel like you're dragging through it. Like, it doesn't. And, like, again, maybe it speaks to the longevity of the writing style, but everything doesn't feel dated because he does not describe it in a way that lets it be dated. Like, all of the technology he describes, all of the setting, like, everything is very, you know, he gives words and names to things, but he doesn't really describe them in ways that are, like,
in our world.
Right. Like, yeah, he doesn't, like, it's a technological device, but he never says things that make it feel dated.
Yeah, like just a poison snooper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or
and then he's like, yeah, it's Snoop's poison.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, okay, got it.
Okay, cool. And then you can kind of picture whatever you want in the modern day, or, like, the book, like, the tablet book that, like, Paul has, it's described in a way that's, like, interesting. It folds into a small piece or whatever, but you can kind of, like, to this day picture, like, an iPhone or something in your,
right,
hand, and, like, that it wouldn't, like, there's nothing in the book that describes it in a way that doesn't feel adaptable. And that's probably why it can probably live on for 100 years from now and still be read in a similar, you know, enjoyment of it, because none of the language feels outdated either, really. Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah, so, and I think I definitely want to read at least the next book.
I think so too. Yeah, I heard that the first three kind of, like, follow an arc,
okay,
and then the next three are something different, but I've heard that, you know, this one can stand alone, you can read them, it's kind of like an all-around solid series. And I think there are prequels, but I think they're written by his son. Oh, and I've heard they're like not definitely not as quality as the original stuff, but yeah.
Well, it's just at least for me, I need to know what happens to Jessica. She's my chick. Yeah, that's all I need to know. Like, Paul, you know, I like him. He's cool and all, but Jessica, I need to know. How are you? How are things?
Yeah, I can't like describe enough like the like interesting female characters that are written, mm-hmm. because Chani is also, we barely even touched on her, yeah. but she's also an interesting character because she's from this like, you know, tribal environment where things are a certain way, but then like is so ready and willing to adapt to whatever Paul like.
She's almost proposes. Like Jessica herself, right. because I think
she's willing to work it, right?
Yeah. Like Jessica's talking to Hara, and she was saying like, oh, you don't think Chani is a good enough choice of mate for Paul. You don't think that he should marry her. And then I think Hara says like, well, you would find agreement with Chani herself. Like she knows that he would have to find somebody like the best possible partner
for him. Understands the game as well.
Like just like Jessica did. Yeah. Of why he didn't marry her or mm-hmm. why she had to like play her role. You know,
it's. And Paul in like a very sweet way, like reassures her and says like, you will always be my, what's the word that he has for her?
Sahaya,
I think. Yeah. You'll always be that to me. Like, don't worry. And I'm like, that's such a sweet thing. And they really do the Princess Irulan dirty. They're like, I hope she likes writing books. Cause that's all she's going to do. Like
she'll never know like the warmth of her husband or something
yeah,
like that.
I was like, damn. But that's, well, I mean, that's interesting, right? Because it flips on its head this, like, patriarchal society notion that something like Game of Thrones describes, you know, where it's like, you have to marry this person because of this reason. And this book takes that angle and it's like, okay, we can do all that or whatever, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
like,
but I'm still going to do
what I'm trying to do. I'm still going to do what I want to do. And, like, and it's really cool because a lot of the book actually describes, like, smashing these norms. Mm-hmm. Because there's also the Fremen have like this, like the Stilgar is confused by like, why you have to challenge me to take lead of the command.
Paul's like, no.
And Paul's like, why would I cut off my right arm when we're about to go into battle or whatever? Yeah. He's like, I need you here. And, but Stilgar's like, but this is the way. And Paul's like, straight changed. Up, like, this is the way. And then Paul's like, but they can change though. And then he's like, and then he brings up a point about they changed something in the past. And then he's like, you're right, ways do change. And I thought that was so cool. Like how the characters are dynamic and interesting enough to understand that, because so many books and movies and stuff are written in ways where like they're hard headed and they don't like he would have been like, no, this is the way my people have done for like years or whatever. And he wasn't like that. He like looked at Paul, understood he's right. Things change. The world is changing around us. Like this planet is changing. There's a whole galaxy out there that he doesn't even know. Like interestingly later, Paul, I think right before they go into battle against the, you know, the Emperor's troops, he like says to him, like on a planet where water falls from the sky. And he was like, so taken aback by that. He's like, water falls from the sky. And then I think Paul mentions that moment. He's worshiping me now. He's
he's like, I've seen him become go from a friend to a worshiper.
And he's worried that's going to happen with Gurney as well. But like interesting, like just all those relationships are so interesting. Like him and Stilgar have interesting relationships. I don't know. Read the book. It's so good. Like,
it's like summed up in that. Read the book.
Like all the characters just have such interesting dynamics to them, story arcs. None of them feel gamey, you know what I mean? Like, you know how in some books you think like this character is doing this because they're a piece of the puzzle, they don't feel like a real person? No one in this book feels that way.
They all feel very dynamic,
intricate, have reasons that they do things, have fears, have like desires. Like all of them are like, they're not just pieces of the puzzle. They all have interesting things about them, and relationships mold and change them in that. It's really interesting.
And that, again, like, I know we've praised his writing style this whole time, but that is a gift. That's a talent, because especially in a book with this many people, to have every single person feel like a fully fleshed out character where you understand their motivations and they, like, the depth of each character. I've read books with two characters that don't have that level of depth. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, these feel like very real people, even though the environment and the world that's being imagined is very unreal.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I can't say enough good things about it.
Yeah. And we're going to keep going, but like the approach to religion was interesting too, because like it didn't feel forced. Like, I don't know how to explain that. Like, it's like with the Fremen, their religion didn't feel like it was like, we do this because it's the way or whatever. Like, it was very adaptable and moldable. And actually something they never fully cover, which maybe they do in other books, is
the
like
Bene Gesserit planning it.
Yes. Like someone was there that planted all this, but did she know that this was going to happen? Because like that, there had to be some foresight there, because they basically have this, like, you know, Paul is going to be the, I mean, well, it's not going to be Paul specifically, but there's going to be the Lisan al-Ghaib that comes, but like, did that Bene Gesserit just do it? Because like Jessica kept saying, like, they've planted this as a safety valve for when one of us shows up here. But then, like, did they actually think that there was going to be this person that was the Lisan Al Gaib that shows up? And, like, did she foresee this, whoever was there before? Maybe it was the Reverend Mother, right? But, like, and it never sums that up from Jessica's standpoint. Like, because maybe she knew past that point whether that was the truth or not. But it was interesting because the whole time, and it kind of shows, like, girls around the world type thing, you know what I mean? But, like, but she basically says, like, yeah, like, someone was here and made sure that whenever another Bene Gesserit came, they'd be safe, basically, yeah. Like, the vibe to it.
Well, it's interesting, too, because they were, like, the Bene Gesserit, they're, like, you know, there is a place, like, in within that women can't go, and that's why they need, like, a male. And that the thing he found was that, what did he say, like, the biggest enemy to a taker is a giver, and vice versa, and that he was saying, like, men are the takers and women are the givers. That was like, that really didn't get touched on much more after he brought it up. But it was a very interesting scene, interesting line. I wasn't sure how I felt about it.
Yeah, I don't even know what it means. What is it? Yeah, fascinating. But it kind of did, I mean, the themes of the book kind of do echo in that though, right? Like, it's like, but then, yeah, because the men were the selfish ones that took a lot of the time.
The Harkonnen definitely.
Yeah. And I guess even the Duke, in a sense, like, even though he didn't mean it in a malicious way, he was still taking the planet, wanted control of it, wanted to beat the Harkonnens at their game.
Kind of wanted to take the Fremen. I mean, not like you said, not in a malicious way, but he wanted to use them.
He wanted to earn their respect, but he still, in the end, right, wanted to use them. And the female characters, I guess, didn't really do that, but they still had, like, well, some of them did, though, I guess.
But they, they had an agenda. So it's like, I feel like they were taking in some regard, but it was more calculated. Well, no, maybe not even calculated, but.
But also, maybe we're misunderstanding it, because Paul kind of describes it in a way that, like, he basically says it's natural for each to have that thing, but they can do the opposite.
Mm.
And it was the poison for them or something like
that. Right, that's their downfall.
And maybe that's the poetry in the book, right? Because that each one that did the opposite was their downfall.
That's true.
The Duke gave his trust to people
freely, and dying. Yeah, and they used it against him.
Yeah,
I feel like this book, there's levels.
It's really something that could probably be analyzed in, like, a, you know, you could have a whole class probably just on this book and the themes in it. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, it is. So I guess we're nearing an hour. So
about that
episodes,
time.
Yeah, our episodes are usually about 45 minutes. So yeah, this was. I'm really glad that you suggested it. It's a really good one.
Yeah, so. I had a great time reading it, and I'm probably gonna move forward and continue maybe reading the rest of the series, see how it goes. But yeah, it was worth a look, and I'm excited to see how either disappointed or surprised I will be at how good the movie is when it comes out in October. So.
Yeah, here's hoping. So yeah, we should do like
a recap episode. Comparison, maybe.
Thank you. Yeah. Compare and contrast.
Got you.
Between the movie and the book, because Indy and I have done that for like a few different series and stuff. Yeah. So, for sure. But yeah, so thanks for being on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. Happy to be here.